This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Garrett Burt. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay, Book 1, Chapter 5, Part 11. On Thursday, the 2nd of July, Monmouth again entered Bridgewater, in circumstances far less cheering than those in which he had marched thence 10 days before. The reinforcement which he had found was inconsiderable. The royal army was close upon him. At one moment he thought of fortifying the town, and hundreds of laborers were summoned to dig trenches and throw up mounds. Then his mind recurred to the plan of marching into Cheshire, a plan which he had rejected as impracticable when he was at Keynsham, and which assuredly was not more practicable now that he was at Bridgewater. While he was thus wavering between projects equally hopeless, the king's forces came in sight. They consisted of about 2,500 regular troops and of about 1,500 of the Wiltshire militia. Early on the morning of Sunday, the 5th of July, they left Somerton and pitched their tents that day about 3 miles from Bridgewater, on the plain of Sedgemoor. Dr. Peter Mew, Bishop of Winchester, accompanied them. This prelate had in his youth borne arms for Charles I against the Parliament. Neither his years nor his profession had wholly extinguished his martial ardor, and he probably thought that the appearance of a father of the Protestant Church in the king's camp might confirm the loyalty of some of the honest men who were wavering between their horror of popery and their horror of rebellion. The steeple of the parish church of Bridgewater is said to be the loftiest of Somersetshire, and commands a wide view over the surrounding country. Monmouth, accompanied by some of his officers, went up to the top of the square tower from which the spire ascends, and observed through a telescope the position of the enemy. Beneath him lay a flat expanse, now rich with cornfields and apple trees, but then, as its name imports, for the most part a dreary morass. When the rains were heavy, and the Parret and its tributary streams rose above their banks, this tract was often flooded. It was indeed anciently part of that great swamp which is renowned in our early chronicles as having arrested the progress of 2 successive races of invaders, which long protected the Celts against the aggressions of the kings of Wessex, and which sheltered Alfred from the pursuit of the Danes. In those remote times, this region could be traversed only in boats. It was a vast pool wherein were scattered many islets of shifting and treacherous soil, overhung with rank jungle and swarming with deer and wild swine. Even in the days of the Tudors, the traveler whose journey lay from Ilchester to Bridgewater was forced to make a circuit of several miles in order to avoid the waters. When Monmouth looked upon Sedgemoor, it had been partially reclaimed by art, and was intersected by many deep and wide trenches which, in that country, are called rhines. In the midst of the moor rose, clustering around towers of churches, a few villages of which the names seemed to indicate that they once were surrounded by waves. In one of these villages, called Westonzoyland, the royal cavalry lay, and Feversham had fixed his headquarters there. Many persons still living have seen the daughter of the servant girl who waited on him that day at table, and a large dish of Persian ware, which was set before him, is still carefully preserved in the neighborhood. It is to be observed that the population of Somersetshire does not, like the manufacturing districts, consist of emigrants from distant places. It is by no means unusual to find farmers who cultivate the same land which their ancestors cultivated when the Plantagenets reigned in England. The Somersetshire traditions are therefore of no small value to a historian. At a great distance from Bridgewater lies the village of Middlezoy. In that village and its neighborhood, the Wiltshire militia were quartered, under the command of Pembroke. On the open moor, not far from Shedzoy, were encamped several battalions of regular infantry. Monmouth looked gloomily on them. He could not but remember how, a few years before, he had, at the head of a column composed of some of those very men, driven before him in confusion, the fierce enthusiasts who defended Bothwell Bridge. He could distinguish among the hostile ranks that gallant band which was then called from the name of its colonel, Dumbarton's regiment, but which has long been known as the first of the line, and which, in all the four quarters of the world, has nobly supported its early reputation. "I know those men," said Monmouth. "They will fight. If I had but them, all would go well." Yet the aspect of the enemy was not altogether discouraging. The 3 divisions of the royal army lay far apart from one another. There was all appearance of negligence and of relaxed discipline in their movements. It was reported that day that they were drinking themselves drunk with the Zoyland cider. The incapacity of Feversham, who commanded in chief, was notorious. Even at this momentous crisis, he thought only of eating and sleeping. Churchill was indeed a captain equal to tasks far more arduous than that of scattering a crowd of ill-armed and ill-trained peasants. But the genius which, at a later period, humbled six marshals of France was not now in its proper place. Feversham told Churchill little and gave him no encouragement to offer any suggestion. The lieutenant, conscious of superior abilities in science, impatient of the control of a chief whom he despised, and trembling for the fate of the army, nevertheless persevered his characteristic self-command, and dissembled his feelings so well that Feversham praised his submissive alacrity, and promised to report it to the king. Monmouth, having observed the disposition of the royal forces, and having been apprised of the state in which they were, conceived that a night attack might be attended with success. He resolved to run the hazard, and preparations were instantly made. This ends part 11.